Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, big changes could soon be on the way for Fresno State. Students are about to vote on a proposal to build an $80 million student union complex. A new performing arts center is on the drawing boards, and there's talk in Sacramento of bringing a new medical school to the campus. We'll hear what University President Joseph Castro has to say and learn why he says Fresno State isn't prepared to take on training doctors by itself. We'll also hear from Roger Bales of UC Merced about why the state needs to revamp the way it manages its reservoirs in the wake of the Oroville Dam situation and global warming. And we'll get the latest on what's going on with downtown Fresno, as work on reopening Fulton Street for the first time in 53 years is nearing the final stretch. Aaron Blair of the Downtown Fresno Partnership will join us. We begin, though, by looking at local government. Something's about to happen in Clovis that hasn't happened in nearly a decade. A small army of county employees will descend on the city next Tuesday to administer the first city council election there since 2009. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports, while some say it's a sign that things in the city have been running well, others say the odd election format discourages the participation of both candidates and voters.
The last time the citizens of Clovis had to take time out of work on a Tuesday in March to vote, this was the number one song in the nation. That's Right Round by the rapper Flo Rida, who likely will not be on the radio when Clovis voters cast ballots for city council for the first time in almost a decade. There was no election in 2011, or 2013, or 2015. They were all canceled.
The incumbents have not been challenged, and so I think the last time that we actually conducted election for them was in 2009.
Fresno County Elections Clerk Brandy Orth says if no one challenges an incumbent or multiple people don't run for an open seat, there's no need for an election.
That's 8 years since the last time voters have had to go to cast for city council. Is that usual?
No, not usually. Not from all of the other cities that we handle. It would certainly seem that the electorate in the city of Clovis have been happy with their elected representatives.
In 1 week, that will change. Three seats are up for election, but only one of the three has multiple candidates. As a result, all three will be voted on. Nathan Magsig was elected to the Fresno County Board of Supervisors in November, but spent more than a decade prior on the Clovis City Council. He was reelected without his seat actually being voted on twice. He says interest in running ebbs and flows based on if there are any hot topics, for example, building a sewer plant, or if there is concern about the direction of the city.
You know, my opinion is that the residents of Clovis have been pretty satisfied. And of all of the city council meetings that I've participated in since 2009, very few meetings were packed where there were a lot of residents that were concerned about any major issues.
The previous canceled elections saved the city money because there was no need to pay the county to run them. But you might be asking yourself, didn't we just have a big election?
We will make America great again.
So let's be stronger together, my fellow Americans.
That's obviously former Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and now President Donald Trump, who were the two most high-profile candidates in a very high-profile election back in November. Supervisor Magsig says in the 1990s, Clovis moved its election to March of odd-numbered years.
And the reason that was done is because a lot of voters at that time believed that the Clovis City Council election was being lost in general cycles, in the presidential election cycle or governor election cycle.
But if the goal was to drive voter engagement, the opposite happened. Turnout in Clovis in off-year elections is consistently about 25% of what it is in November. Fresno political science professor Jeff Cummins says odd year March elections routinely have low turnout because voters aren't paying as much attention, there's less media coverage, and as a result, incumbents get reelected at much higher rates. all of which, Cummins says, makes a government less responsive.
And there's a great irony there in that it's these races, these lower level races, where maybe a few thousand votes, few hundred votes might separate candidates, that one voter is going to have more of an impact, but they don't turn out.
These elections are also more expensive because the city must shoulder the cost on its own without sharing the expense with other cities or the state. It's expected to cost about $175,000. If they ran it in November, the cost would be about half as much. It's also more expensive on a per-vote basis because the cost of running an election is relatively fixed, regardless of how many people turn out to vote. This has been true so consistently for so long, it has sparked a state law to push cities to move future elections to line up with larger state and national contests in the fall of even years. Clovis City Clerk John Holt says they're in the process of moving their election because November turnout rates in the city are around 80%, but March elections only see turnout around 22%.
The transition period over the next 5 years to go to where all of our elections in the city of Clovis are going to be done in November of an even year. The first actual one will be in November of 2022.
In other words, next Tuesday's election marks the last time voters will elect a city council member to a full four-year term in an off-year election. And that might not be the only change coming to the council in the near future. Holt predicts, but isn't sure when, the Clovis will create city council districts and do away with the current system of all the council members being elected at large. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. There are over 1,400 dams and water diversion structures throughout California. Most of the time, we don't pay much attention to them, kind of like other pieces of critical infrastructure. They do their job, and they fade into the background. But months of massive storms after years of drought have suddenly brought the state of our dams and reservoirs to the top of the public agenda. Last week, Governor Jerry Brown announced a plan to spend $437 million on flood protection measures to help shore up potentially vulnerable levees and other critical infrastructure. So what does it mean for the Valley? Roger Bales, an engineering professor and director of the Sierra Nevada Research Institute at UC Merced, joins us now on the phone. Roger, welcome.
Thank you, Joe. Happy to be with you.
Let's start out with the state of things right now when it comes to this winter and the amount of rain and snow we've had. Can you put it in context for us?
This has certainly been a relief from past drought years. Our index sites, which indicate the amount of snow at several locations, are anywhere approaching 50% above average for this time of year, which is good. That means we have not only full dams and reservoirs from the rain that's occurred, but we can expect more runoff for water supply. Of course, the flip side is that creates a problem for flood control, because where do you put all the water that you have to release there? So given that we've had a lot of rain, we have a lot of snow in the mountains, I'd say we're in good shape. I'd say for water supply, the other downside, though, for water supply, the snow line and some of these storms has been fairly high. That is, we're getting warmer storms coming in, which reminds us that we can't count on necessarily the snowpack to be as big a reservoir going forward as we have in the past.
How does this compare with other notable years like the winter of 82-83 that people talk about a lot? Also, the New Year's floods of 1997, that was more of an immediate flood event. But how does this compare with other years, and how can we maybe learn from those years?
Well, certainly this is going to be compared to those past years because of the heavy snowpack and some of the intense atmospheric river moisture that we've had and may still have as the year goes on. The water levels, as my understanding, haven't been quite as high in the Southern Sierra where I am right now as in some of these earlier years. Yosemite Valley, for example, hasn't had quite as high a water level, but we still have some time to go, and that we're not out of the woods yet in terms of the water flooding and so forth.
You mentioned this, but what sort of challenge does this place on water managers, dam operators, when it comes to having to prepare for what might happen and what we already know is going to be coming down the Sierra into mountain streams and rivers?
I really think this is a wake-up call for longer-term planning. In terms of the short term, we have limited options. We can either release the water, or we can hold it behind the dams. It's pointing out to us that we need to provide, in some cases, like Oroville emphasized, enhancements to our spillway capacity so we can release water faster, because if water is coming in to a reservoir faster than it's going out, the water level is going to rise and you can get it up above and go over the emergency spillway. Several of our dams in California have that vulnerability. Second is, as we get these rainstorms during the winter, which some of them used to be snowstorms, but in a warmer climate, some of these big snowstorms are going to continue to come as rainstorms. Where is that water going to be stored? Because it's not stored in the snowpack, we have to release it below the dams. We are doing some planning for groundwater recharge to capture that. We can move levees back away from the floodplain, or into the floodplain, away from the river channel, which helps provide recharge area for groundwater. We can try to engineer systems, or we can engineer systems that divert water onto ag land for short periods of time into recharge basins and implement more groundwater storage in the Central Valley. And that's really something that I would love to see more planning and evaluation on in the Central Valley as a whole, because there are some good sites and there are some poor sites, and we need to identify really where are the best sites to do that from both a geological, a hydrologic, and an economic and social standpoint.
You mentioned the situation at Oroville Dam, and while the situation there has improved in recent weeks since that emergency spillway was put into use and we had that erosion and, of course, the problems on the main spillway, how concerned are you about the situation there? Is that the sort of failure cascade that keeps engineers up at night?
Well, I think engineers are very concerned about the state of our dams and spillways across the state and across the nation. It's been reminded several times that the American Society of Civil Engineers, of which I'm a member, gives our infrastructure a D grade, including our dams in the United States. So these dams are decades old at this point. They need some investment. Much of our infrastructure in California needs some investment, both our dams, our levees, and our green infrastructure. Our headwater basins are not in a long-term sustainable state.
There was a report about a week ago on the Sacramento Bee that said the operations manual for Oroville Dam hasn't been updated since the dam was commissioned in the late 60s, and that it was written based on the rain and the snowfall data for the first half of the 20th century, not including the winter floods of 82, 83, not including the 97 New Year's flood, and not with the changes that we've seen in the forecasting of weather conditions in the last 50 years. Is it time to revisit how we run dams and reservoirs across the board, especially considering global warming?
Yes, yes, there definitely is. And in order to do that, we need some better forecast information. That is, there's quite a debate going on about, can we operate these dams better using information about how much water is projected to come into the dam into the reservoir and behind the dam on a daily basis. And to do that, we need better measurements out there as well as better forecast tools. So there's a debate about switching from some standard operating procedures to actually starting to factor more of these forecasts into the operation of the dams. And I really think that's overdue. That said, we need to operate these dams fairly conservatively, because there is a high risk of a lot of economic and damage and social displacement if there is a flood down below.
Did the drought sort of lull us into complacency on some of these issues, given that it went on for so long and that the infrastructure needs... It's hard to maybe get funding for a dam repair in the middle of a long drought.
Well, when you have a flood, that focuses your attention on the dams. When you have a drought, that focuses your attention on some other aspects of our water system. I mean, water storage was one issue that we talked about quite a bit during the drought. We know that there was severe overdraft of the groundwater basins during the drought to make up some of the shortage in the surface water supplies. And that focused attention on maybe using groundwater storage. How are we going to put that water back so that we can take it out again during the next drought? Also, the other thing the drought focused us on was the state of our headwater basins. When we saw the giant forest mortality in the Southern Sierra with the impacts that has on the runoff and water cycle. And we've had fires during the drought that have focused attention on the erosion and water quality, the impacts on hydropower, the impacts on dams, and so forth. So I think each of these events, whether it's a flood or a drought, helps focus attention. We just need to have a memory and carry that through from one to the other.
You just mentioned something about tree mortality. Do we know anything about whether this massive amount of rain and snow we've had, is this going to in some way turn the tide back on that? Obviously, trees that are dead aren't coming back, but is this potentially helping these trees? Are we seeing any of that yet?
We will see new growth in the forests because the soil reservoir of water is replenished. We don't know if it's going to grow back as conifers or as shrub in many of these areas. We're in uncharted territory here. It depends on what happens next year and the year after as to what comes back. But immediately after the drought resulted in mortality of the trees, there was less water use in the forest, so potentially more runoff. That is, more runoff once the soil water reservoir that was depleted during the drought was refilled up in the mountains. Now with vegetation growing back with this wet period, we won't see that extra bump in runoff going forward. It just points out the need for a more coordinated, thoughtful investment in our headwater management.
And one more thing before we go with Roger Bales here today with the Sierra Nevada Research Institute. We've talked a lot about dams and dam safety, how we manage those reservoirs downstream from those dams. We have the Delta. How concerned should Californians be about not just the environmental health, but with all of this water, the ability to maintain the levees without any major incidents happening there this year?
Oh, I think that is a big concern still. We've seen some levee damage happen already in the Delta, and we need to make sure that we have the monitoring system in place to pick up any further damage. We are looking at demands for levee maintenance in California of hundreds of millions of dollars per year is my understanding on that. Where are we going to come up with that with those funds if we want to maintain these levees and maintain the Delta going forward in the ways that are being talked about and planned right now?
Does that speak to maybe a time to rethink the way the Delta is constituted? Originally, this was the levees are not a natural feature themselves. Is better wetlands management and maybe converting some of that agricultural land to wetlands a potential option or solution?
Well, there's both economic and equity and social and political issues involved there. So that's something that we need open, frank debate on here in the state. Where do we want to put our investments? What do we want our priorities to be going forward? We've always said that we want these co-equal goals for farming, ecosystems, and water export from the Delta. That's becoming increasingly challenging as we go into a warmer climate, variable years like we have seen, drought and wet years. I'm not an expert there, but I'm happy to be part of the debate.
All right. Well, it takes experts like Roger Bales to have that informed discussion, and we thank him for joining us today. He is an engineering professor and director of the Sierra Nevada Research Institute at the University of California, Merced. He joins us today talking about the state of California's dams and other critical water infrastructure. Roger, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Joe.
Stay with us. In the next half of our show, We'll hear from Fresno State President Joseph Castro. He has big plans for the campus, as does Sacramento. There's talk of a new medical school. Well, he wants to build a new student union and performing arts center. We'll find out how it all shakes out. Plus, we'll talk to the Downtown Fresno Partnership's Aaron Blair and learn about a new brewery district that's emerging, as well as the finishing touches on the rebuild of the Fulton Mall. That's all coming up on Valley Edition, straight ahead. Big changes could soon be on the way for the Valley's biggest public university. Fresno State students are about to vote on a proposal to build a new $80 million student union complex. A new performing arts center is also on the drawing boards. And there's talk in Sacramento of bringing a new medical school to the campus. Yesterday, I spoke with University President Joseph Castro to hear more about his long-term plans for the school and to hear what he says about that new bill in the state capitol. President Castro, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to see you, Joe.
You announced in your State of the University speech a few weeks ago this plan for the new student union on the campus. It's been talked about for some time. It's actually going to students next month for a vote. Before we talk about the details there, why the need for a new student union?
Well, yes, there's a proposal for a new student union at Fresno State. We call it the Bold New U. And the current union, which is a wonderful place, opened in the late 60s. And it was built at a time when we had 10,000 students. Today, we have 24,500 and growing. And there's also different needs today that are more 24/7 in nature. So this new union would address the needs of a larger student body with more diverse interests. And it will go on the ballot for students to vote upon in late March.
So are students paying for the entirety of this project? $80 million is the estimate, at least initially. How would you finance this?
Well, the student union part would be financed by a fee that would be paid at the time the building opens. So this is what they would call a legacy vote. The students would be voting on it, and it would take effect probably in 5 years if it were to pass. It will cover the cost of the student union itself. There will be a faculty center that's part of the overall complex that would be funded by the university. And then there will be some private support for the whole facility. So we anticipate that the fee will cover most of it, but the private support will enable us to complete it, as well as some campus support.
There's a lot of talk about these public-private partnerships, sometimes with concerns about, you know, this is a state school. Not just Fresno State is entertaining this. University of Merced, UC Merced, is doing that same sort of thing with their new campus expansion. How would you see a public-private partnership working in something like this?
Well, the student union itself would be mostly public. The private support would come from donors, individuals, or businesses that would want to support the programs themselves. So, for example, supporting the leadership development that occurs in the building itself. There'll be a Veterans Resource Center, so people who care about that. But it'll be mostly public funded. There are public-private partnerships here on campus at Campus Point. We're looking at one for student housing. And yes, you have to be very thoughtful about those to make sure that the university's interests on behalf of the public don't get compromised. And so we go into those with a very thoughtful, careful review to make sure that the university's overall interests are served well and in the end that the students are served well.
I want to return to that idea in a moment and talk about this performing arts center you've talked about. But to go back to the student union, you're asking students to improve a fee increase. This would be about $400 a year for a full-time student, and that's, again, over a whole year. Concerns about the cost of education are forefront across the country. How do you try to sell this to students?
Well, I believe it's a good investment in their success. It will be a facility that supports their 24/7 student success, which is our mission to boldly educate and empower students for success. Fortunately, Fresno State is currently the lowest tuition and fee-charging institution in the CSU, and the CSU is probably the most affordable public system in the nation. So we provide a very good value. We're going to continue to do that. This investment that they would make in the form of a fee increase would take effect at the time the building opens, so 5 years from now. And I believe it'll be worth every dollar to the students that it serves. But again, it's up to them, and they get a chance to decide up or down in late March if this is something that they want. There's strong support for it, but until the vote takes place, we don't know exactly what will happen. I will respect the wishes of our students. So either way, we're going to be ready to proceed.
One of the other things you talked about in your speech last month was this idea, at least it's a concept right now, for a new performing arts center for the university. Why the need for a facility like that?
Well, recently at the State of the University address, I called for a new commission, a president's commission on the future of arts and humanities. And that's because I believe that our arts and humanities programs are very strong and can become even stronger in serving the interests of our students and faculty, and also serving our community interests. So I'm going to ask this commission to explore the possibility of a new performing arts center. And you might ask, well, why do we need one? I'm going to let them do the full assessment, but my sense in listening to the different voices on campus and in the community is that we don't have a venue like that right now in this part of Fresno and on the Fresno State campus that will help our academic programs flourish. And so it would have a range of different arts programs. It would also include some new classrooms that we need, as well as some office space for faculty. And as we've grown, our need for new and modern classrooms has grown as well. And so this would also serve that emerging need that's occurring at Fresno State.
On the same day you gave this speech, which we've been talking about on campus, Assemblymember Joaquin Arambula of Fresno introduced a bill in the legislature that would authorize the creation of a new medical school at Fresno State. It wasn't in your speech. Where do you stand on this proposal?
Assemblyman Arambula and I agree completely that there is a need for a public medical school option in the San Joaquin Valley. I believe that the Valley deserves that. The people that we serve here in the Valley deserve that. I've expressed to him that my preference as president of Fresno State is that we would do that in collaboration with the University of California. I've also expressed that point of view to the University of California. My hope is that as we go through this process, we're at the very early stages with the bill, that as those discussions take place, that we consider that option. I actually think it would be a new innovative approach to serving needs here in the Valley. It would bring the strengths of Fresno State with those in the UC to create something really special and powerful. And so that's my hope, is that through these discussions, if the Assemblyman can help lead us in that direction, and I believe in him, I have a lot of confidence in him, and if the funding is forthcoming, we could do something really special together.
I asked him about this very issue, and he said Fresno State already has terminal degrees in a variety of things. You have the kinesiology program, of course, the educational leadership program that's been going for a number of years. Why not just do it on your own?
He's right. We have three doctoral degrees, educational leadership, physical therapy, and nursing practice. And there's one in audiology that we'd be looking at in the future. I believe that an MD program is very different. And the master plan currently requires that the University of California, they have the sole authority for that. I would, as I said a little bit ago, I would much prefer to do it in a collaborative way because the University of California has strong clinical experience and background and facilities. We could do the basic science part of it, and I think together it could be much more efficient and effective in serving the needs here in the Valley.
Governor Brown keeps warning about the next economic downturn and how vulnerable the state is to to a volatile mix of revenue generation and the way things are right now in Sacramento. How ready is Fresno State for that next downturn? It is inevitable. It's just a matter of when it's going to be. The campus had gone through a lot of pain in the last one. What do you do to try to position the university to be ready for that?
Well, we're certainly enjoying a very good period of economic growth. I came in as president right after the Great Recession ended, and we've been fortunate. We've caught up in so many ways with our infrastructure. The facilities are much better than they were. We've been able to invest more in our faculty and our staff and support for our students. Our graduation rate is much higher than it was just a few years ago. We're leading the nation in so many different ways. At the same time, we know that this is not likely to continue at this level. And so we're trying to get as much done as we can right now, frankly, and to continue building partnerships with individuals and private entities who believe in us, who want to support us. So the private fundraising is going to continue to be very important as we seek to ensure that state funding stays as stable as possible. So looking ahead, we're going to be work as hard as we can. We're going to be as efficient as we can. And then when the downturn occurs, whatever that is, we will be ready for that, and we'll be stronger than we've ever been.
A potential downturn could not only have an impact on the academic programs of the university, but also athletics. The Fresno Bee just had a piece by Merrick Warzowski about what he called the gray wave, the aging of the Fresno State fan base that's responsible for funding a good portion of the athletic program and ticket sales and sponsorships, luxury boxes, those sorts of things. How concerned are you about that? I remember 20 years ago when I was going to Fresno State, people were talking about this same issue. We're 20 years further down the line. How do you turn that trend around?
Well, I believe that our academic and our athletic programs will continue to rise together. It doesn't mean that we're going to win every championship in every sport each year, but we're going to continue to compete with integrity. And I really appreciate that our students are doing better than ever. Our student athletes are doing better than ever academically. We're winning championships in a lot of sports. Football, we clearly need to do better, and we will with Coach Tedford. I think that will lead more people to come to the stadium. We need everybody behind us at all ages. Jim Barco and I are planning to, with private support, to refurbish the stadium, and that will enable our older fans to navigate the steps more easily. We want to create an experience for our families so that adults bring their children. We want as many families there as possible. That's really our goal. And in the end, it's about supporting our own students. You know, 90% of our students at Fresno State live in the Valley. They're from the Valley. These are our students, and so it's all about supporting them and their success, whether it's in academics or in athletics. And my hope is that those things that we're doing to strengthen our academic and our athletic programs will lead to more support from our community.
I saw a stat the other day that said, in fact, it was something you mentioned in your event with Zocalo Public Square in Sacramento the other week, that 70% of Fresno State students are first-generation college students. Is that how significant is that in the landscape of higher education?
That's very significant. It's actually about 72%, but at the same time, that 28%, it's special as well. It represents second and third, and in some cases, fourth-generation Fresno State students. So when you go into a classroom here, you really see the diversity of our population of the Valley and of the state. And I believe, and that's why I serve as president, our mission is to educate the next generation of leaders in our nation and in our world. And those leaders are right here at Fresno State, and they're from diverse backgrounds. We have a number of dreamers as well, and we take pride in that diversity, and we see talent in every different household around the valley. We want the very best and brightest from all backgrounds here, because we know that the next generation of leaders needs to come from the wide diversity of families and backgrounds. So it's a unique thing. It's a pride point, and we love that we have those students who are first generation sitting right next to the third and fourth generation students.
Before we go, you spend a lot of time on social media, or at least you're very active on social media. I was talking with someone the other day, and they said, you know, Joe Castro, he's doing a great job, but boy, he spends way too much time tweeting about what he's doing with his wife or other things. Why are you so active on social media? What's the strategy there? Why do you do it?
Well, I think that being a leader in 2017, it requires me to stay engaged with everybody. And I obviously can't do that in person every single day. So I use social media as a way to share with people what we're doing here at the university, or, you know, where I might be and what I might be doing, because they may not see me every day, but if they know I'm working for them every day, that's important. So it's a way of staying in touch with them. More importantly, I get a lot of feedback from them, good and then sometimes constructive. You know, this is not working. I didn't get this in the way that I thought. Whatever it is, and that gives me a chance to work with my colleagues to do better in meeting their needs. So for me, it's a net plus. It's not a lot of time, actually, even though I do it all myself. I don't rely on people to manage my own accounts. But I think it's time that's well worth it. And I think in this era where technology is so ubiquitous and our students are so used to it, they like that. So if it's an occasional selfie with a couple students in the library, or just saying hello to them and they want to take a quick picture, that happens all the time. And I think it's a valuable use of my time. It's a way for me to stay in touch with them when I can't in person see 24,400 students and a couple thousand faculty and staff every day.
Fresno State President Joseph Castro. Students vote on the proposal for the new student union next month. President Castro, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
This is Valley Edition. A year ago Friday, Fresno city leaders picked up 15 golden sledgehammers and kicked off the project to rip out the 53-year-old Fulton Mall and replace it with the redesigned Fulton Street. It's an ambitious project that officials hope will help jumpstart business investment on what was once Fresno's main street, but for decades has been a struggling 6-block-long pedestrian mall. So, a year later, what's happened, both on the mall and off? We have with us today Aaron Blair of the Downtown Fresno Partnership, a private group that represents downtown property and business owners. Aaron, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
A year ago, it seems like it was just yesterday, but everyone gathered with sledgehammers and jackhammers as well to kick off this event. If people go down there right now, what would they see?
Well, right now we have active construction and basically what's called all three super blocks. So the project's kind of been broken into three separate super blocks. If you come down to the southern end by our office by the stadium, what you'll see is almost a completed street. It's lacking the trees and a couple of the some of the artwork still has to be continued to be finished. But you'll see almost a complete street on the southern end of Fulton Street.
In the other parts, what's happening?
So the northern end is kind of partial streets finished. Partial demolition is still going on. There was a large sewer project on the northern end that had to be completed before the street could go in. And then in the center, Mariposa Plaza, where the clock tower is, where Pacific Southwest building's located. They just started some of the demolition in that block there. So what you'll see there is a lot of fencing's going up. Those businesses are just starting to adjust to having a modified pedestrian access through the fencing and some of the access problems that they'll endure.
Did they run into any problems during the project? You know, you tearing up infrastructure that's been there for 50 years or longer, what happened?
Yeah, I think there's been a couple surprises. I mean, nothing that's been detrimental to the project by any means. But there have been some basements. You know, there's a lot of historic basements there that encroach out into what's Fulton Street. A lot of them were known to be there. It's just a matter of dealing with them. But some of them are surprises where there was historically a building there that probably burnt down, say, in the 20s or earlier, and they found some of the remnants of some of those basements there.
Now, you briefly mentioned the art. There was so much talk about what was going to happen to the art. Was somebody making off with the art? They're taking it for their home, or the mayor is taking it to her home, or it's all going away. It's being sold off. What happened to the art? What's happening to the art?
Yeah, well, she has a great gallery at her house now because all the art's been moved. No, I'm joking.
No.
No, all the artwork's actually being restored. On our Facebook page, we've been posting pictures of a lot of the artwork that's being restored and what it looks like from when it was transported there to the restoration project. There's a couple pieces of art, some of the fountains that are located in Kern Street Plaza in front of the stadium. You can actually watch it. They've been restoring those right in place. They just moved them into their new holding spot this week. And, you know, the benches, the mosaic benches have been relocated, being restored. A lot of times when you go down there, you can watch them redoing a lot of the artwork, especially the fountains that they've rebuilt.
So when can we expect this to be finished?
The original was May. I'm assuming... I mean, they're still sticking to the May timeline, but I'm assuming with all the rain that we've had, I mean, it wouldn't be a surprise if it was June. I think most people can understand that we'd rather have all the rain that we've received and be, you know, a little bit behind schedule if possible.
So with it being done in different sections, not really phases, because work's going on all three of them, are they going to open up one of them first? Because access has been such a concern. A lot of the business owners there, they only have the sidewalk in front of them. And in some cases, on the southern end, I guess it is, you have essentially the street finished. Why not open that up now?
Yeah, I think that they're not going to open it to traffic. What they've done in front of our office, for instance, where most of the construction's completed, they started to take down all the fencing and just left a barricade to stop cars from pulling down, but pedestrians can walk all over the street, everything. I think of it as just liability during the project for the contractor. You know, if you opened it up and started having cars, it just might cause some confusion. But the section down by us is absolutely beautiful. It's really neat to see. It's great to see how they've included such a large sidewalk on the eastern side for the artwork. It's when you walk down to the other parts of the project that haven't been started, you start to see, wow, this is a big difference.
So is this going to be a one-way street or what? Because I've seen the pictures online, and it looks really, really, really narrow.
Yeah, so it's two-way traffic. That's been the top topic everyone wants to know through online is one-way, two-way. And, you know, we've had a picture in our office of two trucks, large trucks on the street side by side that we kind of held back for a while to let people continue to discuss it before we broke the myth that two trucks actually can fit down the street. But, yeah, it's a two-way street.
How have the businesses fared during the construction? You had some prominent businesses that were on the mall when construction opened that aren't there anymore. Mm-hmm. Peeves Public House is gone, out of business. Root General Store has moved off the mall.
Yeah. So Root General is a great store. It's one of the better stores that we've seen open in downtown in the past couple of years. And they were looking for a larger space. And, you know, when the Warner space came available to them, they had to take it. It's just an iconic building, iconic space. We've had some businesses open on the mall, like Casa de Tamales, that opened during construction. We've seen some businesses that had multiple storefronts that have kind of consolidated into a larger space, which has been good for the mall. It's been good for the future of Fulton Street because what it does is opens up some new storefronts for people as we start to see additional businesses looking for a spot downtown in Fulton Street.
So when are we going to see that investment on Fulton Street? We've seen a lot of things off of Fulton Street, Tioga, Sequoia, Bitwise, and the Bitwise expansion, the talk of some other developments south of the stadium, but haven't heard a lot specifically right on Fulton Street. When are we going to start seeing, you know, we've got these big, some people call them white elephant buildings, old, they're beautiful historic buildings, but they're vacant. The JCPenney, the Bank of Italy, the Helm. When are we going to see something happen there?
Yeah, so that's top question I get all the time. So many times we're touring businesses along Fulton Street that are looking for locations. They're like, well, what else is coming? Who else is coming? And, you know, with construction, you know, we do tour quite a few businesses. Some of them are more like regional franchises that are looking at downtown right now. And a lot of them are saying, you know what, I'm going to wait until some of the construction gets closer to being finished. And I think in the southern block by, you know, but down by the stadium with the fencing coming down, we've seen an uptick in activity in terms of, you know, serious businesses starting to look at some of those spaces. So, you know, we have internal goals in our office in terms of new businesses that we want to see. And this year, our goals, we put some for Fulton Street because we realized we have to have a serious impact. We have to have a visual change for people to see at least by the end of the year. So, you know, I'm confident we'll start to see some of these new businesses open on Fulton. I think we got to get through some more construction though before people are willing to take it on, mainly because it is a challenge to operate with construction like that.
About 10 years ago, before you came to town, there was a big plan. Everything south of Kern Street was going to be turned into this major development. They were going to build a Bass Pro Shop, basically level everything wow. that was there, and have some big box retailers and things. Wow. What's happening in that neighborhood now? Because I hear people still say, oh, it's the South Stadium District, yeah. South Stadium Project. Yeah. We aren't talking about Bass Pro right now. This is something a little different that's happening. What's going on there with the breweries?
Yeah, you know, I'm glad they didn't bulldoze those because that South Stadium area, basically south of Inyo, has become quite popular over the past year, mainly because of the old warehouses that are there. Most people that are coming in downtown, they come downtown because they want something unique, and uniqueness usually is ceiling heights, brick, truss systems, things that separate from a standard suburban strip center. But that section right there obviously has been quite popular with the addition of Bitwise Industries down there. Tioga Sequoia has been down there for a couple years now. But what we're seeing is the influx of breweries that are looking in that area because the buildings are perfect for a brewery. And hopefully by the end of this summer, we'll be up to 6 breweries in downtown.
Tell us a little more about that. What's going on? Tioga Sequoia has been there for a few years, yeah. right mm-hmm. across the street from the stadium. Mm-hmm. They're doing well,
yeah.
but there's other things going on.
Yeah, so the great thing about Tioga Sequoia for, you know, number one goal was to make sure that as they continue to grow, that their production facility that they needed to build was going to remain downtown. And I think that was probably goal one for 2016 for us, is to do whatever we could to help keep them downtown. And, you know, when the AmVets building, which is located right next to their brewery, came available, they were able to get that and be able to expand into a 14,000 square foot building for production. So that was number one. We've also had, you know, change in ownership with Full Circle Brewing has been amazing. It's actually put a lot of excitement into that brewery. We've seen leases signed by the 411, which is a brewery that's going to be located on Broadway as well. They're actually going to be our first distilled spirits place in downtown as well. And then we've had leases signed by Border Hops Brewing on Broadway Street as well, across from Tioga Sequoia. So there's going to be 3 on Broadway. So if you're at the stadium, 3 breweries right there on Broadway is great. And then we've also had House of Pendragon and Peter Gabob, which are going in on Van Ness by the Spiral Garage. So again, that'll be a large gastro pub with 40-some taps on handle. And then we have another brewery, Zach's Brewing, that's in the process of finalizing a lease and location in downtown. So that'll get us to 6.
Is this a proven strategy to, you know, this go after a bunch of beer drinkers? I mean, is this a revitalization approach that works in other cities?
Well, you know, what's great for downtown Fresno with all these breweries is they recruit. You know, tourism. So they're great for tourism. They're great for people that want to come in and visit downtown because of the uniqueness of being able to visit all these different breweries. And they're great for downtown when, you know, it's continuing to grow and maybe there's not the highest amount of foot traffic that you need, because breweries can operate without high level foot traffic because they export products too. So it allows them to make plenty of money by selling their products to restaurants and other places. And they're great for employment too. They employ quite a few people. So I think having all these breweries in downtown, I have no doubt we'll hit a dozen of them within the next year or so. I think that, you know, we're going to be aggressive and keep going after them. They're good for downtown.
Now, your role is a little different than a typical mall manager is in a suburban setting where one owner owns all the property. You're essentially a leasing agent or something. In your case, you're not. You
right.
represent different property owners in a downtown setting. What sort of retailers would you expect to to start to come in, or at least what do you hope to happen? We aren't seeing Macy's move downtown probably anytime soon. Are we going to see big box retailers? Are we going to see the Kohl's or the TJ Maxx, or is it going to be something different?
Yeah, you know, if you think of most downtowns that you, if you just list a couple that are your favorite, I mean, you think about what do you go to when you go there, and usually it's something local that's, whether it's local franchise, it's kind of what's the heart of the community, that's what you go there for. You don't go to, say, downtown San Francisco because you want to go to Target or because you want to go. I mean, most people don't, I guess. So I wouldn't expect to necessarily see those type of things in downtown Fresno. It's not common in most downtowns unless you're New York or something like that. But I would expect us to see some more regional franchises. So an example that is like Me and Ed's, right? So they're kind of a regional franchise. You can always snag places like Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts in a downtown. Those are pretty consistent to see. But, you know, I would guess we're going to start to see some, just local flavored businesses and some regional franchises. We're going to continue to push urban manufacturing projects too. So like breweries, which are someone that could export products but still have a place in downtown Fresno.
Is there a risk that things get too spread out? You know, Bitwise is going gangbusters. Mm-hmm. They're expanding all over the place, but they're doing it on the other side of the railroad tracks, R Street or something. And then you've got a few other locations, one on Ventura. Things are kind of spread out. It's a big area. Is that something that keeps you up at night saying, you know, we need to get these things close together so there's walking neighborhoods?
Yeah, that's a perfect example. Yeah, I mean, it does. I mean, we need to cluster more than we do. You know, it's one of those things. Well, even with the breweries, for instance, you know, if I want to cluster them within a 5 or 7 minute walk of each other. But if it comes down to it and we're going to lose them to somewhere else, I'd rather have them, you know, 15 minutes walk apart. But, you know, with Bitwise, yeah, I mean, we would love to see the cluster. But I realize that right now in downtown, properties are very hard to come by. They're very popular. There's a lot of competition for properties. So when you get the opportunity to secure an amazing structures like Bitwise has on R Street, those buildings are phenomenal. So, and, you know, they're doing good products. And Will Dyke, who's the developer with Bitwise, he does a great job. So I trust that they're going to do it right. And we'll find ways to connect them in.
We've got a couple of minutes left. What's happening right outside the stadium with this parking lot and the parking garage across the street? The city's been involved with Terrence Frazier. What's happening there? Because I don't see any construction yet. I mean, I see the mall, but what's going to go on there? Are we getting housing? Are we getting a public market? When is that going to happen?
Yeah, so this summer we should see what's called the park. It's where the parking lot was located, and there's two small buildings next to those. It's right next to our office. Actually, it'll be our new neighbor. So the park project should break ground this summer. I think there were some restrictions about the street had to be open for some of the funding and vice versa with the city. So, that project, they should be submitting for some of their planning department permits here in the next couple weeks, mid March.
And what's it going to be?
So it's going to be mixed-use projects. It's going to have 50 residential living units and 10,000, around 10,000 ground floor retail, but they're going to look right into the stadium. And there's even 3-bedroom units, which we don't have a lot of those in downtown. Second floor swimming pool, can't beat that, looking into stadium. So
that'll be definitely a unique feature for downtown Fresno. Aaron, before we go, you've got an event coming up?
Yep, March 28th at Warner's Theater, the State of Downtown.
All right. Well, we'll expect to hear more about that and find out more when Fulton Street reopens. Aaron Blair from the Downtown Fresno Partnership joining us today. Aaron, thanks.
Thank you for having me.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. Send us your comments, talk@kvpr.org, or tweet us @KVPR and @Valley Edition. You can also find our podcasts and audio archives at kvpr.org as well. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.